Hey everyone, this is KYT and welcome back to Table for Two podcast. A word of warning, this is not financial advice and anything you hear from my co-hosts do not represent my opinion. And with that, enjoy the show.
What's up, what's up, what's up, what's up, BitConnect? No, we're back in person for the first time since 2020.
Yeah.
Is that true? Having some lovely McDonald's coffees with loud drunken people surrounding us because it's like 2 a.m. And Kari and Tom, you top eight at a tournament this weekend, I heard.
No, I didn't.
Oh, wait, no, that must be me. Because y'all must have forgot.
Good old Ottawa weekend, the regional championship. So
yeah, and then we just watched John Wick, where Kari reminded, was like, yeah, he thought he was the old guy. And yeah. I was just, you know, like John Wick, killing a lot of people this past weekend, but in magic. It was kind of fun to be back in the streets again, you know, battling, even though the prize pool's a little lower than one might hope. Like, the American one's 30K to first, Canadian one 3K. But it's fun, standard. I enjoyed myself, not just the magic, but the gathering, you know. I played both Pioneer RCQs, RCs, I guess they're called, yeah. And I bricked the first one. I was playing Blue-White Control. Terrible deck. Second one, I played Red-Black. You know, misplaced gingers, kind of special spice. And it was good. I finished X and 4, some one of those, whatever. Fine result, but nothing special. But this one, I went X1-1 in the Swiss with Esper. And then I lost in the top four to the Esper Mirror. So I'm back on the Pro Tour, I guess, after missing the first paper Pro Tour, I guess first Pro Tour, really, because I paid all the online ones since my first one back in 2011.
Well, welcome back. It's been, everyone's excited, but.
So, yeah, I tested really hard for this event. I played for hours and hours and looked over deck lists and, you know, check MTG Melee and Moto and Arena and just grinded really hard. And so it's really nice to see hard work pay off, right, Kar? No, my first game with Esper was round one of the event.
So, like, I struggle because this is, you know, the podcast of high-level strategy, and I have a feeling that, you know, it's hard to impart wisdom and tips to rising players if I know what likely happened is took a deck for the first time or relatively new to the deck and just used your the talent and the knowledge you've built over time to crush the event.
Yeah, well, I mean, the main thing is just, like, don't play Grixis, because if you play Grixis, you're really stupid. Nah, I'm kidding. Those are not my opinions either. Look, Mike Sigrist told me to play Esper. Rob Anderson, David Schneier, and Bosu lent me some cards for it. And I was under orders to listen to Siggy, so I played the Esper deck, and it was pretty good. Pretty good.
Well, let's get into it. Reminds me of just Joseph Karani's question, which is like...
Oh, yeah. Good shout-out to Joseph Karani, representing Manitoba.
He's killing it. Posting up...
Making a big impact on the format.
Great results in the, I think, at least three regional championship. He's been posting.
He top 16 this three. One. He top 8 the last one, and he won the yeah. Pioneer one, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean,
so what a run.
Though, actually, Liam Kane has won the most matches across all four RCs, according to his own math.
I think we value, obviously, I'm sure Liam just did it for fun. I'm sure he would agree. That top 8 or winning, you know, deserves more credit than just like the match points. Some wanted like an average match point because not everyone can play at every RC. But
well, I guess that brings us something I want to talk to you about today, which is how everybody nowadays values winning rather than getting better at Magic. You know, that's kind of obviously when you get better at Magic, you win more, right? And like. For a lot of people, winning is the goal. But I don't think it was, for me, a lot of my time, it wasn't necessarily the goal. The goal was, like, self-improvement. The goal was challenge myself to become as good a Magic player as I could, right? Like, you know, whether not necessarily even to be, try and be the best in the world, but to just approach perfection as close as possible, you know, like Icarus approaching the sun. And just like Icarus, I guess I fell a little too hard. So it's like, that was always kind of the challenge. That was the road for me, right? To try and get as good as I could be. But it seems like a lot of players nowadays, that's not the goal anymore. You see, like we've talked so much about Magic content and how kind of crappy it is in modern era. But a lot of that is, you know, people just want deck lists. They just want sideboard guides. They want to be spoon-fed things because they don't value getting good at Magic. They value winning their next tournament. They value, you know, having the respect of their peers from having good results, right, that they can show off to people. And obviously that's nice. It doesn't hurt, you know. We're all kind of chasing that pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, even though now WotC's replaced it with a bag of Skittles. But, you know, there's still value in the grind. There's still value in trying to get better, trying to win. And it's kind of cool to see, you know, the modern approaches of it in Magic, where it's a lot about just constant iterations, right? Like comparing the boomers versus the Zoomers play infinite Magic. They just know every deck inside and out. Because there's like 30 of them on a Skype call and they're playing a match and they're doing that 12 hours a day every day and they just love it. They love it. Whereas us boomers, we're too old. We're too old for that crap, you know? Like if I play one match of Magic a day, I'm already like, it's time for my nap, you know? But but it was interesting, especially this RC, to see like the rise of the boomers, right? Like Garrow, he's been around forever. He won. I lost to Omar in the top four, who's not necessarily an OG, but he's been around for a while. He's not a Zoomer, you know? And then the top 16, just full of like Pascal, Eduardo, a lot of the boomers showing that, you know, the kids aren't quite grown up yet.
So to back to the point where you just mentioned, like people just want results. And I know some of us, like we've talked about this before, some of us are just busy adults, right? Like myself.
Oh, absolutely.
Just give me a sideboard guide and let me learn. And D-Room came up with a great point when he said, like, if I'm going to subscribe to a Patreon with a guide, it better be like, just give me the good information. Don't give me like 50 pages.
Yeah, he said the fact that your guide is 70 pages is not a selling point. Right, like, right. Absolutely, yeah.
Just give me...
I jokingly replied to him that I'd sum it up into one sentence for $20. Though, honestly, if anybody wants to take me up on ever, I actually will read the whole guide and sum it up for you in one sentence. If Dave Rude paid me $20, I probably would have been like, take the bad cards out, put the good cards in. But I could probably actually come up with a reasonable one sentence summary for a deck, but there's obviously a balance, right? But I do think that if people are planning to be into Magic long term as a hobby, that it's worth putting an effort into just getting better at the game. And you know, you have your other podcasts with like Andy and Ginger, and you know, Ginger's getting better at the game is like having the best list, having the best guide, and like, you know, playing at a million games with it. And I mean, that part, first of all, that's been what's working for him. Second of all, that's also what makes him money, because people buy his sideboard guides. I think if you're going to just play one tournament and then probably be done for like the year, that makes sense. But I think it's really valuable to understand these guides, you know, because like with open decklist tournaments becoming more and more the norm, you really need to be able to be a dynamic sideboarder, because people's decklists are not the same. And their plans, you know, your plans need to adjust accordingly to what their plans are. One big thing, you know, not sideboarding, but just main deck thing, is like playing against mono white decks in the tournament with Esper. I can look at their deck list. If they don't have any depopulates, I know that like I can just keep jamming the board and try and kill them before they hit 6 mana for farewell, right? But if they have depopulated, my plan completely changes. It's the same thing like post board, you know, they all had depopulates post board, but if they didn't, you know, you don't have to hold up counter spells until they hit 6 mana, et cetera, right? And just kind of knowing how that plays out, what removal spells they have in their board, like what new threats they have, that should change your sideboarding. You know, if post-board they're going to have a bunch of steel seraphs, you don't want to go for the throats, right? Just as an example, even if, you know, sideboard guide says to board them. I think though we do like I disparage maybe sideboard guides too much. Like they are a useful tool. I try and counteract the rest of the world, which seems to like put them as the end all be all and just, you know, buy my guide for $20, which some people have offered me money if I have an Esper guide or whatever. I don't. I wouldn't exactly say I did by vibes, but you know, I boarded in a logical way based off of what I thought my opponent's deck was going to be post sideboard and what my plan would be, whether as the aggressor, whether as, you know, playing a tempo game, a mid range game, or more trying to be like the control deck, let's say against like Toxic. That's kind of what, you know, what you wanted to do. And I think also just being on the play and draw, you also need to change your plans, which in standard nowadays, the winning the die roll seems so important. So many of the cards are just really tempo oriented. Like, because card advantage comes in so many different forms, being the first one to play your Fable and Mirror Breaker, attack with your token, and then kill theirs, you just have such a big mana advantage, right? Same thing, like, if you can play your Rafine and your opponent has to spend their turn killing it, and you can play another Rafine versus, like, they play their Rafine and attack, you can even just block their creature. Then they get to attack with multiple creatures and Rafine and kill your Rafine, add something else to the board because they have more mana. It can be a big swing, and kind of understanding that and understanding how the games flow is important. But there is something to be said to, you know, the method of understanding Magic at a deeper level, right? Understanding like how to have a good thought process in individual games that don't play out in the way you expect. And in the long run, it does save you some time because you don't have to come up with a sideboard plan for every matchup, right? Like famously, I know we love to talk about John Stern, who you referred to as Canada's heart, right? When I was the head, and
I didn't say that. Josh Bennett said that, right?
Oh, maybe. You love to quote it though.
Okay, I love to quote it. Yeah,
and yeah, he was one who was always a preparation god, right? He would spend the night before just being up late making sideboard guides for everything, while I'd be asleep in my bed, just, you know, getting my brain ready for the next day. And so, yeah, it was very complimentary styles.
I think again, the other style that you mentioned is just easier to understand what to do. Like, I don't want to generalize what Misplaced Ginger does because I haven't followed him like directly what he actually does, but like,
you wouldn't have to watch him very long.
You're describing people that might come to this maybe close or to the same conclusions you are, but they just have to play a high volume of games, right? If they play this particular matchup, like, I won't say 1,000 times, but enough times, there's different cyborg configurations from their opponent, they're going to eventually, if they're good, come to the same conclusions than you do, except it's just going to take them a lot longer. So for your approach, is it more the lessons that you've learned over time because of, you know, aggressor, defender, or things that translate over time? Or are you able to replace thousands of games on MTGO or Arena by having just a conversation with Sigris and other people in your group?
Yeah, I mean, okay, well, I'll say, like, right now I'm pretty unplugged for Magic, right?
Right, right.
I don't really play very much, especially, like, I used to be playing a tournament almost every week, let's say, you know, when I was really in it. But I never was one for playtesting a ton of games. I would watch other people play, and I would talk to people, and I'd read articles, and I'd look at deck list, and, you know, I'd watch coverage and stuff like that. Like, I would absorb a lot of Magic knowledge. And, you know, I could play some sort of play out some games in my head sometimes, but really the idea for me was not to memorize play patterns, but to understand the texture of a format. Especially like when I would play test games, I would try and play with all kinds of decks. You know, I'd be happy to play with the enemy deck in play testing, for example, because I think when you understand what every deck is trying to accomplish and how the strategies kind of attack each other, you have like a higher level understanding, and you can use that to work your way downwards to get like lower level plays, rather than kind of the way people approach it now, which is like the opposite. They're working from the bottom up, right? And yeah, obviously my large experience of Magic has helped. Like, I, you know, and partly that I have memory of situations and, let's say, combat situations, but a lot of it is just I've built a good framework of how to approach decision making in games. Or, you know, obviously it's useful in other things, but just you get to a scenario and, like, how do you determine what to do, right? Like,
right,
it works in Magic or in chess. I mean, I originally built it up from chess, right, where you're in a spot and, like, you have a different, you have an option of like 50 different moves, right? And then each one of those moves, your opponent can do another 50 moves and you can respond with 50. And it quickly becomes like a web of so many different possibilities that you can't actually calculate everything. So how do you, like, narrow down? How do you shortcut to which, like, things are better to look at? How do you examine those possibilities, you know, and go as deep as you can in the chain? Obviously, you do have to go a certain depth because, you know, the deeper you can go, the more accurate things get. But it's kind of the same in Magic that, you know, usually you can discount lightning bolting yourself on turn one, right?
Right.
And then there's other heuristics you build up over time. But, like, you can build up those heuristics from understanding, like, the two decks and how the matchup goes and how, and, like, what your game plan is and what your opponent's game plan is. And from that, you can eliminate a lot of the useless potential plays.
So I always thought, and maybe this was wrong, that every time there's a new rotation, there's a new format, that there's just so much to learn, or it's just so different. But it's probably more different. It's less different, rather, than I thought. There are these lessons and experience that carry over, and I shouldn't treat every, like, I'm testing. Let's say I would be testing Grixis against Esper Legends. If I started to play now, I'd probably think all the lessons I take just, like, only matter in this particular moment, rather than seeing maybe there's some things I can learn that can translate to,
yeah, exactly, the next. I think it's valuable to try and look for the greater pattern, right? The greater understanding of, let's say, you know, like, people play the Grixis Mirror, and you can learn, right, more than just how Grixis Mirror works from playing the Grixis Mirror. You can understand, like, for other mirrors in the future, you know, the kind of where to balance board presence versus card advantage versus life total. And when you learn those lessons, you can port them over to future things, even if the decks aren't exactly the same, the format's different, you know, instead of Fable, the Mirror Breaker, there's something else. You can still use that understanding to make the learning for the new deck things a lot faster. And that's kind of my approach, like, to learn things really quickly. And using my kind of understanding of Magic, mm-hmm, I approach it that way. But also, I think there's so many people, when they approach a spot of Magic, they don't really think. They mostly just play by intuition, you know, and a huge amount of that starts from the fact that people start playing Magic because it's a game, it's for fun. And, right, you know, they eventually move into competitive Magic, which is still fun, but it's different, right? Your goal is not necessarily to do the fun play, the cool play, to see what happens, right? Your goal is to win. And for that, you often will have bad patterns to just make a play. And one of the things from testing nonstop is you can break those patterns because you realize this play is bad. You know, if you just, like, use your removal on their Blood Tithe Harvester, then you won't have something for their Shieldred, you know? Even though, like, previously you're used to just killing everything on sight, let's say, right?
That's an evolution I went through, actually. Even for, I think, Limited. At some point, absolutely. Then later on I would know, oh, I only have X amount of removal in my deck. I can't just use them so liberally at, like, a little threat that, versus some of their bombs that might come up later.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you're playing a black-green deck, and your opponent has, like, a 3-3 creature that they attack you with. You can either kill it or take 3 and go to 17. Often the right answer is to go to 17 because you need to save those removal spells for flyers because you don't have good flying blockers in your deck, right? Just, obviously, an example. But there's other times where it's like, look, your deck has a million removal spells, and you know, you have a bunch of cards that, like, draw cards and you lose life or something. You probably need to conserve your life total. You should probably kill that creature. You'll have a removal spell for a flyer in a later time. And, you know, those two decks function differently. You have to understand that.
It's so interesting because you know how, like, in chess, I think I'm trying to think of how you would answer this. It's because some of the strength of, like, let's say a grandmaster is that intuition, is that pattern recognition. And
oh, absolutely.
People recommend at a certain level, my level, to get to, at least on my road to 2000, is grind a lot of puzzles, right? To get that feel, right?
Yeah.
So what would you say to that then? Is it more that it's kind of different, or?
Well, it's somewhat different because the thing with chess, right? Chess, you're always playing the same board with the same pieces.
Correct.
So when you're learning a puzzle, the fact that that situation will come up again, you know, is always a possibility, right?
Right.
That is kind of like playing a million games with Grixis, that you're, you know, you will be ready for when that situation happens with Grixis. But then the next season comes around and you're just back at square one, right? Because you haven't, like, taken any higher level lessons from what you've done.
Okay, yeah.
The way I kind of view it in chess is, like, at a lower level, before you're a master, you, like, learn your openings, right? That's like practicing with your deck, sort of, right? And you don't necessarily know all the openings. But if somebody does something you don't expect, it's very important to know the basic opening principles so that you can make good moves there, even though you're outside of your memorized like moves. To know that, like, getting pawns open, gaining control of the center, development, these are good things, right? It's kind of the same principle in Magic. Like, these are, you know, card advantage is good. Getting on the board is good. Having, you know, higher life total, having tempo, being able to dictate the pace of the game. These are all good. And, you know, making your opponent use their mana awkwardly, almost always valuable. Making them use removal spells on your secondary threats or counter spells on their secondary threats, always good. Knowing, like, when to play around things, when not to play around things. These are all valuable things that are timeless, really. Even if, like, the balance of things has shifted, that, you know, getting stuff on the board is more valuable than it was back in the day. Card advantage is less valuable, right?
I like when you mentioned that difference. It reminds me of an experiment they actually did where they had chess players solve puzzles that could occur in the actual game versus positions that would almost never come up based on the pawn structure and stuff. And they had a hard time with those other positions that were not familiar, that didn't come from
In
actual openings.
Yeah, I mean, it's like Fischer random, right? Where Fischer suggested having a random assortment of the pieces instead of them all being in the same position as in every game. And he thought that that was a better version of chess to understand who had better chess skill. And that's kind of a closer game to Magic, really, right? You know, the play patterns with certain decks and certain matchups. Obviously, if you can afford to play 14 hours a day, every day, playing Magic like Ginger or a lot of the Zoomers do, then you're going to be really well prepared. You're going to be better prepared than I am, for sure, you know? And testing is really important, and, you know, I don't recommend to other people to do what I do and go to tournaments with no testing, you know? I don't even really recommend it myself. Like, if my goal was to go into the tournament to win the tournament, I would prepare for it. If my goal right now is kind of just to have fun, you know, I'm approaching Magic as like a hobby and a way to hang out with some friends, you know. When I approached it as a job, because it was possible for it to be a job, then I would put in a lot more work, even if it wasn't, you know, necessarily jamming games. It would still be, I'd still have Magic on my mind a lot.
Relatively speaking, not jamming as much as the grinders, because I just want a takeaway from let's say a little kid, even like, you know, my boy, shout out to Avery Mathers, who had a good day one in Ottawa. Fortunately, he couldn't convert that into top eight, but shout out to Kerry Dan's son and like people that might be fans of yours, like what they could do to try to follow in your footsteps. And I'll go back because I mentioned Karani because he had a good question for us, which was, how big of a size of a team would you want to have? Is it better with a small or big team? But before you answer that, actually, I appreciate that you wore the manadeprived.com shirt. Shout out to the blog site that honestly we sort of co-created together. I came up with it.
You created it, but I was your number one editor.
You were my number one editor and
fan. other than maybe your mom.
And people may have forgotten. I mean, I think listeners of this show probably know, but like more recent players that are new or just know of you because they've heard that a lot of people consider you the best Canadian player of all time. But back in the day, like Pro Tour Barcelona, we had a huge team because at the time, the ethos of Mana Deprive was to help basically every Canadian. Every Canadian that needed help, we were going to help them. I know a lot of people just like, even whether it's like book tickets or just have a little opinion on decks, that's why the Mana Deprive team was so big, but not everyone necessarily contributed to the final deck, right? And it's like,
yeah.
So given that, and your experience since then, obviously, with so many different teams, yeah, like what do you say to Joseph, who is looking to, let's say, have success at the Pro Tour level?
Yeah, well, he's trying to be the next generation, right? And I'm looking forward to it. There's a lot of contenders for the title. There's a lot of, you know, newcomers who've got that spark, who have something, you know, and they got a little bit, maybe a chip on the shoulder, and they need to work for it, you know.
This is what I don't get. I think COVID just made it, like, well, that's why I said to Kyle Duncan, I'm like, is Alex really a boomer? COVID just made it seem like we took a long break, right? I don't think you were number one pre-COVID. I don't think anything changed for me not to put you number one post-COVID.
Yeah, well, they created the misplaced ginger scale, a list based off of the former Mark Anderson scale, which has misplaced ginger at zero, and then players on a positive numbers above him and negative numbers below. And the original version of the list had me as at the third highest spot behind Edgar and Eduardo. But I'm happy to say that mistake was quickly remedied. But all right, back to the question of teams and Mana Deprived. I mean, Mana Deprived was huge. I think a lot of people don't really realize how disconnected people were a lot in back in the day. You know, you mentioned earlier when we were just chatting before of how, like, you didn't have access to the pros the same way you do now, partly, you know, Twitter, partly just how everybody's kind of so involved with the internet. Like, John Finkel was a mythical beast, right? He was like, people were like, careful how you draw your cards against John Finkel, because he'll know right away what you drew just from looking at your face. Like, obviously that's not true, all right? John's very good, but he's not a god. but, like, people believe that stuff, and like being paired against him in the top eight for Avacyn Restored, like I was nervous.
I was freaking out, man.
Yeah.
Like,
but yeah, best I mean, even just time. In Canada, we were disjointed. We were in segmented communities, and kind of you making the Mana Deprive website sort of brought us together into more of a cohesive group. And yeah, for a while, David Kaplan and I, you know, we'd come up together sort of, and we both felt that like there hadn't been anybody there to sort of mentor us as we rose up. Like, I've maybe even spoken before on this podcast of how, like, my idea was I didn't have good players to test with, so I just made the players around me better so then I could test with them and get myself better as well. And kind of, yeah, so we felt like we wanted to help the Canadian Magic community. We just let every Canadian who wanted to had an open invitation to test with us.
Yeah.
We did that for Hawaii. We did that for Barcelona. Afterwards, things got complicated because we kind of leveled up as a team. Like, we had a bunch of people who were on the train, and we decided we wanted to have some more consistency. We wanted to start working with some other high-level international people and try and, you know, make waves, which I think we succeeded in.
Yeah, but I believe so.
I mean, the evolution ended up becoming team face-to-face. And, I mean, we broke multiple formats, had many people top eight. We won a couple of PTs. And the Canadian Magic scene seemed to grow and grow with people not on our team at all, top eighting and sometimes winning events. And that was always really cool to see that almost every PT seemed to have its requisite Canadian in the top eight. But yeah, so in terms of perfect size of teams, I found that I've had big and I've had small. And I think somewhere like, for me personally, I think 12 is around the cap. After 12, it's too many.
Okay. 12 is a lot too.
Right? It's a lot. I think that you gain benefits from having more people. It's especially true in more open formats or brand new formats, because there's way more work to be done, way more exploring. Nowadays, you know, the internet's a huge resource, and a lot of formats, when before the tournaments, happen already exists. There's already been some other tournaments. There's tons of data available. You kind of know most of what's going on, and you're kind of trying to figure out which of the decks is best and then tune a good version of that deck. But if that's not your goal, then you do need a bigger team, like 12 people, I think, because you need to have different people working on trying to break it, sort of, as well as people kind of tuning stock decks as like a fallback, right? Personally, even on those bigger teams, I've had a role where I'm like the organizer, where I like just basically boss people around and tell them, like, you two, you're going to work on this deck, you two are going to work on this, and then kind of collate the data. But I've also often been the one like trying to come up with new stuff. And especially in that role, I work best with like maybe four people maximum. It's because otherwise it's just kind of too many cooks in the kitchen. And I don't think that like more than that, working on like a singular deck is that productive. So like if you're in a group of 12, you should basically have subgroups that like, you know, communicate what you're doing, but are working on different projects. That way you don't overlap on the same thing. And yeah, I especially have often worked with just like one person because I find someone I'm in sync with and who I feel like I'm going to have reasonable data from, because I've always had the, you know, cue the tiny violin, but I've always had the problem of like playtesting with people and they're a lot worse than I am. And so, you know, we have a matchup and it's like 70-30. That's, you know, it's like, well, is that the matchup or is that me? Well, I have a story with Vincent Thibault when we were testing for a Pro Tour.
Story.
Yeah, it's a classic story. We're testing for a Pro Tour. I wasn't even qualified for. This was like in 2010 or something. And he was, and we're testing a matchup of like Pyromancer Ascension versus Ad Nauseam. And we played like six matches with me on Pyromancer, him on Ad Nauseam. I won all six. He's like, all right, this matchup's good for Pyromancer. I'm like, I don't know. We switched sides. I won six matches with Ad Nauseam. It's like, well, what is it? You know? Well, it was good for Ad Nauseam, and once I showed him how to play it properly,
then we
could figure out that Ad Nauseam was better. But that's a lot of time wasted. It's much better if you can find someone. You don't have to find someone exactly as good as you, but someone close enough that you can both agree how a matchup's supposed to go. That's also one of the values of switching sides. But
I have a curious question, fun question. Like, is having like at least a few people that are like mad scientists in terms of deck building, is that good or maybe overrated because they often come up with like a pile of crap for you to play?
Well, I mean, I forget who has said that 99% of everything is crap, right? And so if you have these mad scientists on your team, you have to accept that most of the time they're going to come up with crap, right?
Right.
It's important that you don't have the whole team burning all their time and energy on that, on the potential of that deck being good. You want, you know, the mad scientist, you know, they can have a partner or whatever. And most of the time, yeah, it's wasted, but the time where you find something, those are big payoffs. So it's like,
So would you,
it's a bit of a gamble.
Would you cap the amount of mad scientists on your team?
Yeah, I think I would. I mean, especially nowadays where things seem to be like more clear cut in what the decks and the good cards are. Like the powerful cards are just so much ahead of everything else, right? Rafine, Shieldred, Fable. Those cards are just, you know, S pluses, right? And then it's very hard to build a synergistic deck where the cards, you know, Pascal tried with his green white auras deck that I had multiple people come up to me and say, yeah, I just won this round. I played against a draft deck. But, you know,
other people said it was mind-blowingly powerful. Like Dahlia.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's, I mean, they won 60% of their games or something with it. Right. So who knows? We'll find out probably in the American RCs, but the point being that it is worth having like a couple brewers on your deck, on your team. You want to have good brewers because, there's some people who, instead of 99% of their stuff being crap, it's 100%, and those people, it's not worth having. But though, even those people, like, there's stories of Conley Woods back on Team CFB that, like, nobody ever played a Conley brew. But when people are working on their decks or their brews, that Conley sometimes would have, because from his brews, would have cards that in mind for to fill slots or ideas, you know, that could work synergistically with other people's stuff. And that's often worthwhile, I think. Sometimes it really just takes one card to make a deck. You know, the classic example of the Miracle deck that, you know, was a 20% win rate deck without Feeling of Dread and a 40% win rate deck with it. That's like doubling the win rate, you know? But I don't know if you saw this article from the guy, Benson Madsen, I think his name is, who came second at the Pro Tour. It was about how... I don't want to throw too much shade, but like, it was kind of about how he's not good at Magic, but he's good at eating. And like, he like prepares chicken and rice and broccoli or whatever beforehand, and he has it with him, and he makes sure to drink and like get a good night's sleep and bring a cushion for the chairs in the convention hall, just so he's like comfortable and well fed and stuff. And how he like used to be 400 pounds, but now he's lost a bunch of weight and like he doesn't have a lot more energy and stuff. And obviously, a lot of the stuff he says is true, but a lot of it is like, you know, kind of obvious, and some of it is like, you know, it is nice to get sideboard plans and a deck list from your friends. I can attest to the deck list part at least, and you know that matters too. And you know, playing well matters as well. There's all kinds of factors in. I mean, I remember my old chess teacher would say that he would like spend a lot of time exercising before a major chess tournament. And I think it's real. Like, you know, when I was younger, I was young and fat, and that I could handle. Now I'm old and fat. I need to get old and skinny if I want to grind tournaments again. you'll realize you got a chess tournament this weekend. You're gonna play an open tournament, play against players of all kinds of ratings. It's kind of like what RRC was, you know. But yeah, are you excited to play some chess again?
Yeah, I am. I don't know. I just want to test myself in something that I hope to eventually teach my daughter and have fun with.
Whoa! She might hate it. I thought I was gonna teach your daughter.
Okay.
Come on, we agreed that I was going to do the searching for Bobby Fischer, like wipe all the chess pieces off the table and like visualize, and then break out the certificate and say that, you know, I'll just like the experience of getting to be really, really mean to a child. You're not sure? Last time I came to your place, I gave her a king, and she immediately grabbed it and put it in her mouth.
Yeah.
She's a natural.
I don't know why I've chosen to get back into chess, but I've been having fun with that. I can't really...
Well, that's good. I mean, it's fun to have a hobby, and like these competitive games are good too, you know, especially in your old age, keep your mind sharp.
And it's just a lot of... I said doing puzzles, a lot of sharpening my openings. I'm not studying in too much. Like, I'm still gonna get wrecked after 5 to 6 moves, but just hopefully come out of the opening okay and have fun. It's just like 2 rounds per day.
Oh, so just 4 rounds?
Just 4 rounds, and they just rank you by, I guess they have their own tiebreaker system, right? And
was it Spassky who said when you teach and when you lose you learn?
I hope he's right.
So you're gonna do a lot of learning this
weekend. I'm gonna do a lot of learning.
I did a lot of teaching in Ottawa.
I just like chess. I feel because I can learn at my own pace, and the game stays the same, so the lessons just keep carrying over, and that's why I really, really enjoy it. And Magic, they do, like we discuss, but it's just less obvious to me. Like, you have to really, I think I learn a lot just from like talking to you or talking to another high level player about why they sideboarded that way. Like, I need to have conversations. And for example, what you said about watching games is very interesting, because recently there's something called the Capcom Cup. It probably happened actually more than a few weeks or maybe a month ago, where a player out of nowhere, this is like a Street Fighter V tournament, like a really big one, qualified and beat a bunch of legends, destroyed a matchup, finished second. But then he was asked, you know, how did he learn to play a certain matchup? And he said he never practiced it,
but he watched it on YouTube multiple times.
Nice.
To pick up the nuance and how people were playing that matchup. So he understood the interaction. So it's like kind of like...
Yeah, I mean, I think like watching streams or something can help, you know. You can watch Ginger's stream. You can see like how to lose with Grixis, you know. Ginger, I hope you appreciate all the shade. He told me at the RC he wanted me to give him a beat down, you know. But I think he was expecting to be on First Strike podcast before you said you banned me from that.
I couldn't handle it anymore.
No break. It was too much. But yeah, no, there's something to that. Like my favorite thing in testing was to watch two players playing, and then when one player would make a play that I would ask them why they made that play. And obviously some players, like, they couldn't necessarily respond because they didn't really think about why they made that play. They often made it just intuitively. Or, you know, sometimes they'd have a reasoning and then they would realize, oh yeah, this other play is better, you know, which is the play that I was planning to do. But sometimes they would have a reason that I hadn't thought of and I would learn something. And I think that's like more valuable than just making the plays yourself, because you're always going to make the plays you're going to make, right? So it's interesting to see someone else's perspective and to understand really why they did things. Like, have you seen the TV show Heroes? Old show.
A long time. That's with... Yeah, a long time ago, but only a few.
Yeah, episodes. Do you remember the villain in like the first season? His name was Siler.
Yeah,
and he would cut people's brains open and see how they worked. Like that was kind of my magic method. I was Siler, except without the killing. I would just try and like look at great players, watch them play, and try and analyze like what made them tick, like why they made the decisions they did, how they approached things, and kind of try to download it and adapt it into my own style. And I work to a certain extent, you know. There's only so much you can do. And of course I would learn more from the analytical style players more than the intuitive style ones. But the intuitive style ones are still, there's still a reason, even if they don't consciously know the reason why they're doing things. And it is interesting to see like what your gut sometimes tells you, especially now that we're back into the realm of playing cards with people in person. Physical tells are a huge thing. Whether or not like you consciously notice them or you unconsciously know them. Sometimes you just get that feeling in your stomach that they have the fourth go for the throw in their hand, even though, you know, logically it makes no sense. And then they actually have it, you know, and you're just picking up something, you know? But on that note though, I want to say how broken masks are in the new meta. I was the only one in the top eight wearing a mask, but I got to say, you know, like, first of all, okay. You can say what you want about COVID. It's better to not have COVID than to have COVID, right? But even that, just before, I would always come back from tournaments with the PT plague, as they called it, you know. I would just, either whether it was from a flight or from a convention center, just shaking so many hands and being around so many people, I would get sick. And maybe my immune system's extra powerful, whatever. I would just always feel terrible. And I haven't been sick since I started wearing a mask at tournaments, and that's nice. Then also there's the fact that your opponents just can't read your expressions that much. Which I think I noticed, like, my opponents were more intimidated by me than normal. Like, they normally are intimidating.
Right.
But you know me, like, I'm always like laughing and joking and smiling, right? But they can't see my smile when I have a mask. So they don't know. They don't know that I'm. They're just intimidated. They're like, wow, this guy has an incredible poker face.
You can be pretty stoic in really important moments, I think.
Yeah, I can be. But when I'm talking to someone, you know, they don't know if I'm serious or not.
So you think that might have led to the most talked about moments?
Well, that and me waving my hands and saying, "This is the attack you're looking for." It takes a long, long time to learn the ways of the Force, young Padawan.
At some point, once he starts, I guess, tapping the card, you knew it could happen, that he could just...
I mean, when I played my Shieldred, I knew it could happen. I obviously, if he just turns his creature sideways, I'm dead.
Right.
Let alone just Rafine, you know? As Mike Sigurs put it, if he was in that spot, he wouldn't even look at his hand anymore. Draw a card face down, attack with Rafine. Just draw one, discard in the bin. Game.
Right.
But like, when he starts tapping mana, you know, I'm just thinking, like, he doesn't have, I know his list, he doesn't have Toulouse, You know, like it has to be Adeline to have add another creature to draw an extra card. So he had it. He stacked it the right way. I just like he announces how he stacks, and I hold my breath because I don't want him to like say this the other way. But once he's drawn those six cards, and I point to my shoulder and say there's six shoulder triggers on the stack, and his face drops. That was it was a satisfying moment.
Commentators went insane.
Yeah, it was a crazy lucky moment for me. You know, like on day one, last round, my opponent showed up late. That was a nice other look. You know, say one thing about Alexander Hain, say he's lucky. But it's nice to be lucky sometimes, you know. Even though I have a quote on Twitter that said Andre Strasky saying that I'm the unluckiest Magic player. I didn't even pay him to write it. He just did it because he got to witness at a team Grand Prix. But no, in the long term, luck balances out. You just gotta, you know, talking with Philippe Garreau, who won the event after we ID'd and we're just having a walk outside in the to get some fresh air. He was telling me what he was gonna give in his winner's speech, and he was gonna say that, you know, you gotta focus on what you can control, right? You can control your deck, your play, your preparation, your mindset. You can't control your draws, your matchups, you know, what weather it is having and stuff. And you just focus on what you can control, and you just basically, you know, everybody gets lucky sometimes and unlucky sometimes. The difference is that the good players take advantage of the times that are lucky and then top eight the tournament. Because even the very best players, right? Like, I had to go like 11 and 1. Like, that's an unreal win percentage, right?
Yeah.
That's not, I don't win that much every time. You know, even at a tournament at this level, like, it's, you know, it's way beyond how, but if you get lucky, you have to take advantage of it and get that 11-1 and 1 or whatever, you know. Sure, sometimes you'll be unlucky and you won't make day two. Shout out to Andy Peters. But sometimes you will, and you'll be in the top eight of the event. You just have to, you know, whereas if you're like the better players, you know, when they're unlucky, they finish in the top 64. When they're lucky, they finish in the top eight. And whereas the worst players, you know, they'll a little bit worse, they'll top 16 when they're lucky, and maybe they won't even day two when they're unlucky, right? So it's just, you know, there's both increasing your floor, so decreasing like the worst that can happen, and then increasing your ceiling, increasing the best that can happen. And they're both like different skills, and different Magic players are better at each of them. You know, someone like Reed Duke, for example, who our most recent PT champion, is well known among the pros for having a really high floor. He never just like spews off infinite, you know. He's gonna be there. He's gonna try his best. He's gonna come up with solid plays, but he's not always gonna come up with the like crazy brilliant plays, right? But he's gonna make mistakes incredibly rarely, and because of that, he has incredibly consistent results. And you know, I'm really happy he finally got a PT win because he's a good guy and a great player. But there's other people who are maybe more swingy, you know. Andre Strasky may be an example, you know, a player at least who in playtesting Siggy and I referred to as the bye, because he would just like, he could never win in playtesting, but when it comes to a tournament and his mindset is just there and he's rock solid, you know. You kind of got to understand where your strengths are and where your weaknesses are, and you know, play to your strengths and try and minimize your weaknesses. And just try to be better than you were yesterday. Don't worry about top eights. Don't worry about how good your friends are, how good other people think you are. Just try and get a little bit better than you were. And eventually the luck will come and you'll hit some results, because results come as a reward for getting better.
Right. Let's wrap up this episode with what, like, your most requested question, which was to have you either rank, give a top 10 list, or rank the provinces, or do a bunch of that crap. I'm leaving it at the end because, right, you know, well, these are not my views. These do not reflect.
I thought you said you wanted me to read this list right here, Carl. You signed your name on it. You signed your name on it. You wrote "from both of us" car. You said it's from both of us. You said misplaced ginger number 72. All right. Well, if I had to, I'm sorry to all you egomaniacs out there, but Ontario, you're not number one right now. Quebec is still the king in the north. You know, even if you discount me, there's still Pascal who's iterating new decks. There's Eduardo who's grinding it out and still playing technically well. You know, Trudel, who won the first world slot in the East. Garou, who now has won the second one. You see players like Alan Ngo, who kind of crushed it out west and then was like a match away from top eighting this one as well. I mean, there's some Quebec players have some chops, you know. Right? Like, shout out to Sebastian Lachance, by the way, who's, I think you described him as a new and better you.
Yeah.
Who's doing incredible, great community work. And I think those people are always really underrated. And it makes a huge difference. It really does. To have someone like that who, you know, as a player, you can know that somebody's watching and you have resources to find out other players to connect with, to see when events are. And yeah, I think that's really cool. But he put a list of 18 Quebec players to look out for, and 7 of them finished in the top 16. Now that's pretty good work. So yeah, number two province, it's probably Ontario. But as a proud Quebecer, it's hard to say. The Ontario was number one for a little while. Did you know?
No.
I moved to Toronto for a month or so. But Manitoba, Karani, making a name for himself. He's also been crushing it lately. So Alberta, in terms of population, probably up there. You know, BC. I don't really know. You know, I my way of knowing, you know, is I've always subscribed to the fact that watching a player play, you learn way more than looking at their results. That results, you know, are like a symptom rather than of being good at Magic rather than being good at Magic itself. But
so you don't really have like,
I don't have a
top five, top 10 lists or,
oh, of players. It's so hard to say. I mean, I played against a bunch of players this weekend who I thought played pretty well against me. I've watched other players play, and I've seen good things. I've seen players have good results. But how can I really, really say, you know, we judge players off of like one thing we see, one mistake we watch, one event they top eight. Another player, you know, just has Magic's a game of inches. And it's so hard. And, you know, Ginger's and in your podcast said everybody's terrible except for his friends. You know, I have perspective on that I think that, you know, there's really two ways you can look at it, that either every single human being is terrible because we all make tons of mistakes, we all have a long way to learn, or there's like maybe 10 people in the world who are not terrible at Magic because they make like a relatively small amount of mistakes. And I personally subscribe to the first thing. I think that, you know, we are all imperfect. And we're all striving to get better, right? And just because someone's like worse than you right now, hey, they might be better than you later. Just respect your opponents, be nice, put positivity out in the world, you know? Just, it costs you so little to give someone a boost. And it just makes the world a better place, right? But yeah, shout out to all you grinders trying to chase the rainbow, you know? It's a fun pursuit, you know. Just be kind to yourselves and, you know, take things with a grain of salt. You know, you aren't your latest Magic results. And the whole point is just to try and improve, try and have fun out there.
Yeah, I think only thing I wanted to say was like after I made the apology for the episode. You know, some people were quick to try to make me or Andy or Derek feel better, like with these, like, oh,
Andy, no, you should feel terrible.
Andy
lent me his Lambo, you know, those type of tweets. Spencer and Mason were just trying to be really nice, but and everyone was having fun dunking on Misplaced Ginger because Grixis didn't have a good weekend, but ultimately it wasn't like that opinion that was the problem with the episode. It was the fact that he made it sound like it sounded like he was making rising or new players that played with a certain deck or achieved a certain result with a different deck out of Grixis. He made them feel bad or dumb for their choice. And yeah, that's not...
And that sucks.
Yeah, that sucks. That's not something that I want to be approving. I'm sorry for... I've already apologized a lot, but like, again...
Yeah, I'm sorry for anyone on this podcast who I made feel dumb except for Ginger. But... No, I again, you know, like we're all on our own journey. We all start at different places. Some people have more time or more inclination, you know, that they learn some stuff quicker. Other people learn other things quicker. And, you know, it's at the end of things, you know, it's a game we put our like hearts and souls into, but it is still just a game. And we're all human beings, you know, should be kind to each other, have respect for one another. Obviously, if somebody cheats you or punches you in the face, that's another question. But if somebody's just playing a different deck than you, you know, don't look down on the mono red players. All right, even if you're a mighty, brilliant, big minded Tron player, you know, have some respect for the little guy.
At the same time,
yeah, Tron is the best. Yeah,
everyone on Twitter loves the trash talk. A lot of people do. And I love it. It's just that I only regret it mainly because our show, with the F2F tour being so popular, it's attracting like new and rising players, and that was the problem. I have no, like, if Ginger thinks he's the best player in the country, like let him think that. Like, it doesn't mean that it's true. And
yeah, it does mean though that he needs some to see some help. There's a few specialists who specialize in delusions.
But like, if he were to say that to you, it's like it's whatever. It's his.
Yeah, yeah, it's his prerogative. Honestly, if he says it to me, that's fine. Right. I don't mind. You can be cocky, you can trash talk, but like it's better to do with your friends or your peers, right?
Right, right. Yeah, I 100% agree.
Like, don't do it to people who are like just starting out and who aren't, you know, who are just trying to find their footing, basically.
All right, I think we've talked enough.
Hopefully, I need to go to sleep.
All right.
I have a baby to take care of.
See you guys in the next one.
Peace.